I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. During the first enrollment period for health insurance under Obamacare, about 263,000 Marylanders signed up for Medicaid, the federal health program for the poor. Nationally, the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare accounted for 4.8 million new enrollees. But that number would have been significantly higher had conservative politicians in 19 states not flatly rejected federal Medicaid funds for their poorest citizens. In this hour of Midday, a look at what might be the final battle in the war over Obamacare, the states that have just said no to Medicaid, and those still debating whether to accept the federal funds. We speak with observers in Louisiana, Texas, and Virginia. Midday starts after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, WYPO, Ocean City and the Eastern Shore, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. I mentioned WYPR.org to also remind you that we have podcasts available of all of our shows on our website and also listings of forthcoming shows here on Midday. Next month marks 2 years since the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act, the landmark health insurance law known as Obamacare. While ruling in favor of the central piece of the ACA, the court limited one significant portion of the law, which sought to expand Medicaid to cover millions more poor and disabled people. Medicaid is a joint federal-state effort, and the court said the law's requirement, the ACA's requirement, that states rapidly extend coverage to new beneficiaries or lose existing federal payments was unduly coercive. That's the Supreme Court. The court said states would have the option to accept federal funding for the expansion of Medicaid, an option. Under the ACA, the federal government would provide 100% of the funds for the first 3 years of implementation to each state to provide Medicaid coverage to low-income adults who previously would not have qualified. In Maryland, a strongly Democratic state, the Medicaid expansion was welcomed, and now some 263,000 people have been enrolled in the program here, but 19 states have flatly rejected the federal funding for Medicaid expansion, denying coverage to millions of low-income citizens, a phenomenon that an MIT economist calls almost awesome in its evilness. We're going to talk about this today on Midday. We're going to take a look at some of the states that have decided not to accept the funding for Medicaid expansion, and one, Virginia, that's in a stalemate over the issue. In Texas, Republican governor and former presidential candidate, maybe presidential candidate again, Rick Perry, is flatly against accepting the funds, which would have expanded coverage to more than a million Texans by 2016. We'll speak with the State House reporter for the Dallas Morning News, Robert Garrett, a little bit later in the show. I'm also going to be speaking with Robert Mann. He's a professor at Louisiana State University who has been critical of Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal's refusal to expand Medicaid in his state. We're also going to take a look at Virginia, as I said, which is currently in a stalemate over the issue. The recently elected Democratic governor, Terry McAuliffe, barely in office more than 100 days now, is at odds with his legislature over the issue and is reportedly trying to figure out ways to bypass the majority Republican General Assembly in Virginia to get the federal funds for Medicaid. Laura Vazella of The Washington Post, who's been covering that for The Post, will be joining us in just a few minutes. But I start the conversation today with Brad Herring. Brad's back with us from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he's director of the PhD program in health economics and policy. And he, along with Jonathan Weiner, have been a big help to us in explaining Obamacare since, I think, this goes back 4 or 5 years now, Brad.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Nice to have you back on the show.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, we started talking about the different aspects of the ACA as proposed in 2009, 2010, yeah. And then tried to explain it to our listeners afterwards. But this particular piece I thought was worth going back to look at because we had Medicaid expansion in Maryland. In fact, the bulk of new enrollees, people with health insurance now, came through the Medicaid expansion in Maryland, right?
Yeah, yeah. The vast majority of the people who are gaining coverage in Maryland are getting it through the Medicaid program, which is a public program geared for families at or near the poverty line. Actually, historically, it's been really geared for families with a target towards kids and their parents. And the recent ACA expansion is really trying to make it more inclusive to draw in a bunch of adults without children.
The expansion covered people up to 130 whose income is up to 138% of poverty, right? So it went beyond the usual Medicaid eligibility.
Yeah. So the poverty line for a single individual is probably around like $10,000, $11,000 a year. So we're talking about like $14,000, $15,000 a year in annual income. If you're a single individual, if you're a family of four, it's more like, you know, $30,000 or so.
Congress figuring there, these are folks who probably can't afford private insurance, even subsidized insurance.
Yep, that's right. And so, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, the Medicaid program historically started off really, really small for just families on welfare, and then over time expanded to pregnant women, over time expanded to parents, going higher and higher up the income eligibility line. And in essence, like the poor people who were left out prior to the ACA were essentially these adults who didn't have children, and also parents to a lesser extent. I mean, parents were covered up to about like half of the poverty line, and so this is really trying to raise those eligibility levels, bring in more people in poverty.
Now, so the Supreme Court left it up to the states. They said that Congress could not basically try to coerce the states into this expansion. So they left it up to the states. And right away, we heard from governors in about half of the states that they would not be accepting federal money through the Medicaid expansion. Mostly, no surprise, Republican governors.
Yeah, so this is entirely partisan, right? So a lot of times you kind of say, oh, you know, this is kind of partisan, and there's elements of it. I mean, this whole thing is like entirely partisan. And so to walk back a little bit, like the Medicaid program is jointly financed by the state and federal governments, and here in Maryland, it's about half and half. And in poorer states like Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, it's a little more like three quarters of the funding is from the federal government. And that's historically, right? So the ACA came along and said, look, we're going to try and cover more people, largely these uninsured adults, and we're going to do it in a way that has the federal government covering all of the costs initially.
For 3 years.
Yeah, for 3 years. And then almost all the costs, like indefinitely. So scaling down to federal government covering 90% of the funding, right? But here was the catch, right? The ACA, as written, basically said to states, you've got to do this. You've got to expand, or you're going to lose all of your prior Medicaid funding for all the people you've been covering since, you know, like mid-60s.
And that passed without a single Republican vote.
Right. So the ACA, yeah, just totally partisan. And so interestingly, like Supreme Court decision comes along, everybody's like focusing on the individual mandate. And this Medicaid issue is just totally flying under the radar. Supreme Court surprises a lot of people and says, you know what? Yeah, like that is actually kind of coercive to have the states risk all of their old funding. And that in turn, like made it optional for the states, right? Many people like myself said, well, okay, like, you know, these governors that are posturing saying they're not going to do it, they'll come around, right? It's so much money on the table. How could they do this? They'll come around. And surprisingly, or maybe even not surprisingly, like
they haven't. There's been a couple who have changed on that.
Yeah.
And there's, I think, four or five states where this is still being debated, but fully 19 where there's been flat rejection of it.
Yeah.
Now, Jonathan Gruber, I quoted him. He's the MIT health economist who I think worked out the Massachusetts plan. Right?
Oh, sure. So he worked out the
kind of famous
plan.
Right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sorry. So
yeah.
I quote him. This is somebody with some credibility.
Right.
I mean, that comment may seem kind of extreme to you, awesome in its evilness, but the idea of denying health coverage to millions of particularly vulnerable people, low-income, poor people, may seem to some people is pretty evil.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, you've got to be really, really partisan to not expand your Medicaid program when there's so much money on the table for you.
Let's see what's happening in Virginia. Brad Herring will be with us for the hour from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. You're welcome to call in at any time. 410-662-8780 is our number for Midday. The email address for questions or comments, midday@wypr.org. Laura Vazella, who used to work with me, or I used to work with her at the Baltimore Sun, now covers Virginia politics for the Washington Post. The state is facing possible government shutdown over this argument in Virginia over a Medicaid expansion. Laura, thanks for joining us on the show.
Hey, Dan. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah. Haven't talked to you in a while.
I know.
Boy, are you trying to keep track of the governor and the legislature down there? Please tell us what's going on today.
Well, it's an interesting mix here. It's a very much a purple state, and you really see that in Richmond, where Terry McAuliffe won statewide, but the state House of Delegates is overwhelmingly Republican. The Senate is evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans, and it has some moderate Republicans. And in the Senate, there are three moderate Republicans who side with the Democrats, and they are prepared to go forward with at least a version of Medicaid expansion. They're calling it something else. It's a private option plan similar to what was done in Arkansas. But basically, they want to take that Medicaid money but enroll people in private insurance. And they thought that might be more appealing to Republicans in the House, but they have not budged. And this is the Governor McAuliffe's top priority, and so we're stuck. It was folded. The Senate proposal is in the Senate version of the state budget, and until they get past this impasse or Medicaid comes out of the budget, nothing's happening on the budget either. So we could have a state government shutdown if they don't resolve this by July 1st, which
July
is the
1st.
Start of the fiscal year.
Just a couple of numbers, Laura. So how many people are we talking about in Virginia that would be covered, and how much money are we talking about in terms of federal dollars?
It would be 400,000 people in Virginia, and that would amount to about $2 billion a year, or as Terry McAuliffe likes to say, $5 million a day from the federal government. Now that, you know, that's at the 100% rate, and then it eventually obviously ramps down to the 90%, and that's the Republicans' objection, is that when it ramps down, that's $200 million that the state has to come up with. That's anyway, that's part of their objection, that's not an insignificant sum. And they also just question whether the federal government can really afford to live up to this commitment, given that it's overextended in other areas.
Does Governor McAuliffe have an end run here? Is this something he can do without the legislature's approval?
Well, not clearly, but he certainly is looking at, I read the other day that he's looking at his options for doing an end run, finding some way through an executive order or some other administrative action to expand, because the House really has just dug in and has shown no signs of budging. However, so we know he's exploring that, and there are a lot of different theories floating around. There's no clear path, however, in part because, well, primarily because the state constitution requires that the General Assembly approve all appropriations, even pass-through money from Washington would be need to be appropriated. So that's the sticking point. But there, it's possible, and if you want to know the details, I'll tell you the details. But they're looking at ways they can do it, but it's not clear yet that he can.
Okay, Laura, here's a question from Brad Herring.
Yeah, hi. So, hi, Laura. Thanks.
Hi.
So I guess I'm curious about the extent to which, if any, the local hospital association, I assume there's a Virginia Hospital Association, and wondering if they're pressuring these Republicans, right? Because the money you've talked about is really ultimately going to flow primarily to these hospitals to replace uncompensated care that they're providing now.
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely. There is a Virginia Hospital Association, and there was a hope on the part of expansion proponents that legislators in, particularly in rural districts where the hospital is the main employer, and that they would maybe be susceptible to pressure from their local business community and the hospitals themselves, but it hasn't worked, at least not yet.
You know, this is a very important point that you raised, Brad, and I wanted to bring this up today. The Congressional Budget Office came out with a new estimate on what this is going to cost the states. And it's not as high as had been dreaded or as the CBO itself had earlier estimated. The real cost to the states, this is from an analysis of the CBO report that was issued just a couple weeks ago, the real cost to the states will be even less because if they expand Medicaid, they will no longer have to pay for much of the emergency care of uninsured people that now takes place at hospitals and clinics. Estimates of this savings, according to the Congressional Budget Office, range from $26 billion to $101 billion through 2019. So that's significant.
For sure. Yeah, so the uninsured do indeed receive a fair amount of uncompensated care. I mean, the care they receive and isn't as great as it would be if they had comprehensive health insurance coverage. But it's a lot of money, and partly the reason it's a lot of money is because that often happens in inefficient settings. But the sources of uncompensated care are varied, right? So a lot of it comes from the federal government in terms of the nonprofit tax exemption. A lot of it comes on additional payments from the Medicare program to these safety net hospitals. But a lot of it actually are state and local governments, and actually local governments get in the mix because often property taxes kind of work their way towards the local public hospitals that predominantly fund uncompensated care.
Hey, Laura Vizzella, before I let you go, a political question then about Governor McAuliffe and this particular issue of Medicaid expansion and support for Obamacare in general. When he was running for governor, how big of an issue was this for him? How did it play out politically in his election?
It was clearly his top priority. However, he sort of just squeaked past his opponent, Ken Cuccinelli.
Right.
So many people have said, well, you know, did he really have a mandate to do this? Was this just a rejection of Cuccinelli for some other reasons, you know, the very conservative social issues, that sort of thing? So he didn't come in with a clear mandate, even though this was his top priority. But at the same time, he also ran promising to be, work in a bipartisan way. And so he doesn't really want to shut down or want a war with the Republicans. And yet, they have not been open to his entreaties, so it could hurt everybody all the way around. If there's a shutdown, no one's going to come out looking good.
Well, you have a pretty interesting story to cover there, Laura. So thank you. Maybe we'll check back with you again on this.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, nice talking to you, Laura Vizzella, formerly of the Baltimore Sun, now covering Virginia politics and the legislature, the General Assembly in Richmond for the Washington Post. Brad Herring is with me from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health as we continued our discussion about states that have decided not to accept federal funds to expand Medicaid. When we get back, we'll hear from Robert Mann, a journalism professor at Louisiana State University who writes a lot down there. Had a recent op-ed in the Times-Picayune, very critical of Governor Bobby Jindal's rejection of Medicaid expansion in Louisiana. And later we'll hear about what's going on Texas on this matter from Robert Garrett, who covers Austin, the statehouse, for the Dallas Morning News. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Brad Herring from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, along with Jonathan Weiner, one of our Obamacare experts who have helped us along for fully 4 or 5 years now, explaining elements of the law as it was implemented, or as it being debated and then implemented. And one aspect of it we're focusing on today is the Medicaid expansion part of the ACA that isn't happening in 19 states. 19 states have flatly refused to expand the program. And so we're taking a look at those. Virginia, they're still debating it, at least. I don't know where it's going to go from here, Brad. But some people may wonder, you know, just how long can Republican governors hold out for this money? Because hold out not accepting this money,
yeah,
right? Because there's the cruelty aspect that people will look at and say, well, how can you not accept federal funds of this degree for low-income people? They have health needs, too. On the other hand, There's an economic argument too, right? This is money that trickles down, does it not?
Yeah. And as I mentioned earlier, like, you know, I was wrong before kind of predicting they'd come around. And even still, like with 2014, I thought maybe they'd come around because up till now it's been kind of monopoly money, right? Hypothetical money. But starting January 2014, I mean, these are real federal dollars that you're missing out on. And maybe this is finally gonna move things forward.
Well, the argument has been that it's too much. We still can't afford it. Even at 90%, even at, when the federal government, when it drops from 100% down to 90%, even at that level, we, Louisiana, we, Virginia, Texas, we can't afford it.
So, I mean, that's the economics of the argument, right? So one is definitely just the politics. But, the economics is that, yes, you know, eventually it's going to scale down to 90% federal funds, leaving the state responsible for 10%. And many of these states just kind of say, look, like we don't want to raise taxes in order to cover that 10%. And then I think on top of that, there's concerns, I think partly well founded perhaps, that maybe in the future there'll be budget deals going on in the federal government that will actually decrease that 90% in some kind of grand bargain budget deal, you know, in the future.
I mentioned before that the Congressional Budget Office had come out with a new estimate on the cost of expanding Medicaid, and I didn't give the full number. In February, the CBO estimated that expansion would cost the states $70 billion through 2024.
Okay,
its revised number is $46 billion. So, I mean, that's significant. And the price reduction, or the cost reduction, comes from those, you know, what I mentioned before. The real cost reduction is in uninsured people showing up in emergency rooms and in clinics, and the state having to pay for it.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. I mean, I think another couple of things which have led to some of these cost estimates from the CBO being lower now than originally anticipated. I mean, one is actually that the federal spending from the federal government is lower because fewer states are taking them up on the offer to cover all the Medicaid costs. But another reason is that healthcare spending over the last 5 years has actually been really low relative to historical growth. And
that's a fact that's a bit under the radar still.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
We're seeing a drop in the cost, a total cost of healthcare.
Yeah. I mean, it's still expensive and it's still rising, like generally higher than inflation, but it's slowed. And I think in turn that's kind of spilled over into the federal estimates being, projections off into the future over the next decade are going to be lower because we've got now a smaller base, and maybe the projections are going to be a little less than what they thought they would be.
This is Midday on WYPR. Dan Rodericks here with Brad Herring from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. 410-662-8780 is our number. Toll-free long distance, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. And the Midday email address for questions or comments, midday@wypr.org. Before we go to our next guest, one last thing here. This is from the Kaiser Family Foundation, Kaiser Health News. Just want to read this. Their number is 8.5 million. While 8.5 million uninsured low-income adults could have been eligible for Medicaid in the states not expanding their programs, only a small share of them are eligible for Medicaid today. Because Medicaid eligibility in states not expanding their programs is limited, only 10% of the uninsured adult population that could have been reached by Medicaid under the ACA is eligible. That's about 870,000 people. Mm-hmm. The remaining 90%, or 7.6 million uninsured low-income adults who could have been eligible for Medicaid coverage, are instead ineligible because their state is not expanding Medicaid. That's what we're covering today.
Yeah.
Now, if these state legislatures change their minds and suddenly, I don't know, what would make that happen? Because it's so political, right? There could be expansion in those states still.
Yeah. No. So that's right. So just because you've made this decision thus far doesn't mean you're locked out of changing your mind in the future. So at any point in time, any of these states can change their mind and expand their Medicaid programs and take advantage of all that federal money.
We're going to take a look at another state now, Louisiana. Republican Governor Bobby Jindal has been adamantly opposed to Medicaid expansion in his state, despite recent polls that suggest A majority of residents there favor the expansion. We're joined now by Robert Mann from Louisiana State University, who's written some op-eds for the Times-Picayune. A particular one we wanted to talk to him about is the one in which he's been critical of the governor's decision and the legislature. So, Bob Mann, thank you very much for joining us here on the Midday Show.
Thanks, Dan. Good to be with you.
Was there a recent vote on this in the legislature in Louisiana?
Well, not a vote by the entire legislature. It has been considered in committee, and the most recent vote in the Senate Health and Welfare Committee a couple of weeks ago was a pretty resounding vote against expanding Medicaid along party lines. So it hasn't made it out of committee. This particular bill was a little bit different, which was an effort by some legislators, Democrats, to bypass the governor and put the question of accepting the Medicaid expansion program to a vote of the people in the form of a constitutional amendment, and even that couldn't make it out of committee.
You know, it's understandable why Bobby Jindal would be opposed to this, right? I mean, he's still thinking about running for president, I guess, sees himself as a presidential candidate, and he's not going to change his mind. It would look like a big flip-flopper at this point. But in the point you make in your one of your pieces is about the local legislators, the state legislators. You say here, what I don't get is how state legislators don't understand that helping Louisiana's working poor is good politics and good policy. I want you to talk a little bit about that, Bob Mann, because some people think, you know, that the poor don't count. They don't vote.
Well, they do count, and they do vote. And in fact, the most recent congressional election we had down here, which was a special election last year, in which a congressman who resigned abruptly, special election was held, and there were two Republicans running against each other in this runoff. We have open primaries down here. The person who was allied with Governor Jindal and favored to win took a very strong position against Obamacare, against expanding Medicaid, and in fact made it the primary issue in the election. The other guy was opposed to Obamacare, but said we ought to take the Medicaid expansion money and campaigned on that, and he won a resounding victory. Because there were enough voters, and this was in northeast Louisiana, one of the more conservative parts of the state, there were enough voters up there who saw the wisdom of what he was talking about, and what and felt that it's unwise to turn that federal money down. That I think that that you'd find just about anywhere in the state a clear majority of people who would support it, And I think that's why Governor Jindal and others fought so hard to keep this from being put to a vote of the people in the form of a constitutional amendment, because it would be an embarrassment to them, and it would result in the state being forced to have to accept this money.
So it's pretty clear what Jindal's doing here. This is President Obama calls it political spite, you know, all the rejection of the Medicaid expansion across the country, but in particular in Jindal's case, this will play pretty well in Iowa, won't it?
Yeah, and I think that's what it's all about. If he were just playing to his voters in Louisiana, it wouldn't be much political risk to be for this. I don't, you know. First of all, he's term limited. He can't run for another term. He's in the last 2 years of his 8 years as governor. The political risk to him in Louisiana is nil. This is all about his standing on the national stage. His hopes to catch the eye of conservative Republican caucus goers in places like Iowa and primary voters in places like New Hampshire and South Carolina and Florida, because he wants to run for president and he can't have the taint of anything associated with Obamacare on his record.
Let's just talk about the numbers a little bit in Louisiana as they applied to Louisiana. The 100% of federal funding would come in in the first 3 years of the ACA, the Medicaid expansion, and then that would drop to 90%. Still, the state would only be on the hook for 10%. Does that argument, Jindal makes that argument that it would be too costly for Louisiana?
Yeah, he does. Ironically, and I pointed this out in a column a few months ago, that in 2008, when he had just been sworn in as governor, he expressed a tremendous amount of concern over the number of uninsured citizens in Louisiana, the indigent, the people that he now refuses to cover. He expressed a lot of concern about them and applied to the federal government for a waiver, for a program in which he would cover a couple of hundred thousand people using the Medicaid program. And at that time, he was willing to pay, I believe, it was either 25% or 30% of a state match, and that was a good deal to him in 2008. Today, a 10%, 0% match for 3 years, and 10% for the remaining seven, is a bridge too far. And I think that what it shows is that in 2008, he had no idea of running for president, or at least wasn't plotting a presidential campaign. And a very large state match was not a problem. Today, it is a problem. And the only thing that's changed that I can tell is that he's decided he's going to run for president.
Run for president from 30% to 10%. Brad Herring has a question for you, Bob.
Hi, Bob. So,
hi, Brad.
I guess a number of conservative states have tried to, I guess, maybe thread the needle by saying, well, okay, maybe we'll go ahead and expand our Medicaid program if we can do, you know, the private option, right? Really expand it in a way that
make it
emphasizes
look like
private.
Make it look like a private
plans, yeah. I mean, whereas the irony is most states actually used private Medicaid managed care plans anyway, so this would kind of happen away. But at least in terms of the political optics, and I guess I raise this issue with you in particular because Arkansas, just to the north of Louisiana, really just like tried to move forward on really branding this as expanding Medicaid largely through private plans. And I wonder if that has gotten any traction in Louisiana.
Well, that is essentially what Jindal did in 2008. He's already covered significant proportion of our existing Medicaid population. 900,000 of the 1.2 million Medicaid recipients in Louisiana are covered by a very similar privatized managed care program called Bayou Health. And so what I wrote something about this not long ago that, you know, all Jindal has to do is apply for the same kind of a waiver for to just expand the existing program to include the additional Medicaid recipients into this program, follow the Arkansas model, and he could even call it the Jindal plan because he had enacted his plan long before Arkansas and any other state had done it. So I think if he were really just concerned about the Louisiana politics and just being able to sell it and make it palatable in Louisiana, he could do it very easily. The problem is that's a hard sell in places like Iowa, and he's just not willing to do that. But I think that's exactly what he could do, and it would be a good way to thread the needle, perhaps. I think one concern that people have about that is that those programs don't end up covering as many people as they would if you just accepted the straight Medicaid expansion money.
Yeah, that's right.
But it still would cover a lot more people that are being covered now.
Hey, Bob, I just want to ask you this question, sort of a national political question. If all the Republicans continue to call for the repeal of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, they're all singing from the same hymnal on this. Governors, legislators, members of Congress. This continues into the fall, into the midterm elections. I'm sure we're going to keep hearing this. I just wonder how long can they sing that song? Because the Affordable Care Act is law, it's happened. We've got, 7-8 million people enrolled in it so far, and Medicaid expansion in 26 states or something like that. So I just wonder, what's the payoff here in the long term for Republicans?
Well, I think the payoff in the short term is probably not bad for them in the midterms because it's going to be an older, wider, more Republican electorate, and that anti-Obamacare, anti-big government message appeals to them. But I don't think that long term that this has a whole lot of currency. Even in places like Louisiana, if you saw the New York Times poll that was published a couple of weeks ago, in which they polled states, a few states, including Louisiana, on health care. Mm-hmm. There's a majority, even in this state, that says that they don't want the law repealed. They want it to be either kept as it is or improved. There were, I think, 52% who took, if you add them together, the fix or keep as is amounted to a slight majority. And I think that's the thing that that Republicans won't acknowledge, even in states where they have accepted the Medicaid expansion, is that if you look at the numbers, yeah, there may be 60% of the people in that state say they're against Obamacare, but a good 10% to 15% of those people who are opposed to it are opposed to it because they don't think it went far enough. They're for single payer or some other form of government health care. And if you factor those people in, I think just about everywhere there's a good workable majority in every state that wants to see it maintained or fixed. And so governors who aren't running for president, like John Kasich and Jan Brewer and a lot of other Republican governors, have found it easy to do with what they've done. It's the Republicans like Bobby Jindal who are running for president who can't have that taint of Obamacare on them, and the poor people of their state are being sacrificed on the altar of this man's of Bobby Jindal's presidential ambitions, and that really is despicable. I can't remember the term that you quoted earlier, but that's a pretty strong way to describe it. But I think that that people are suffering and dying because of at least Bobby Jindal's presidential ambitions.
Yeah, the phrase was almost awesome in its evilness.
Yeah.
A comment from Professor Gruber at MIT, who was an architect of the healthcare plan in Massachusetts, saying that about the governors who have decided to not accept the Medicaid expansion.
And an architect of the ACA
itself.
ACA,
too. Yeah. Hey, Bob Mann, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, Robert Mann holds the Manship Chair in Journalism at the Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University. He blogs at Something Like the Truth. Dan Roderick's here along with Brad Herring from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We'll take another short break and continue our conversation in just a moment. When we get back, we'll be joined by Robert Garrett, reporter for the Dallas Morning News, and we'll talk about Texas's rejection of Medicaid expansion. Please stay with us. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. The LA Times calling Medicaid expansion the final battle in the war over Obamacare. Pretty comprehensive coverage in the LA Times of this issue. You can find a link to stories from the LA Times on Medicaid expansion on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Before we go on, let's take a call from one of our listeners, Marilyn in Bel Air. We welcome you to Midday. You're on with me and Brad Herring's here in Studio A. Hi.
Thank you. My question and seeking some information is that I don't think that we are making it clear to the public that it goes beyond just being humane or kindly or charitable in increasing Medicaid coverage, but it's lives. It's a matter of life and death for many people if they are not covered by Medicaid. And how we can get this very important point over to these governors. Now, if we had the figures, like, for instance, Harvard, when they did the study in Florida, and they found that they published 70,000 plus people may die because of this, when that was made public in Florida, Florida's governor reversed himself, and he is accepting the Medicaid. Now, how can we do this to the other 19 governors? And where can we get the information to get breakdowns like that?
Mm-hmm. Marilyn, thank you.
Organization that we can just flood these governors with the facts of life, that it's beyond just being charitable.
Right. No, I'm with you. Thank you for making that point. We've talked a lot about the politics here, but not about so much the health consequences of this.
Yeah. So that's tricky. I mean, there is indeed like a small body of literature that tries to do just what Maryland discussed, right? Try and actually examine what happens after a state changes or expands its Medicaid eligibility and actually focus on health outcomes like mortality, for instance, or other morbidity things. I mean, to be candid, the literature is a bit mixed. There's studies that do find some positive results and other studies that don't find results. One study just came out examining the before and after of Massachusetts expansion, Romney care, so to speak, finding that it indeed reduced mortality. There was an Oregon study that used a lottery to essentially award people access in or out of their Medicaid program, and some of the, they didn't look at mortality, but some of the more finer elements of health actually couldn't find much improvements.
So I assume with time we'll know more.
Yeah, so a lot of us researchers, we're chomping at the bit to get the data to see what happens,
I want to introduce into the our show now Robert Garrett of the Dallas Morning News, because we thought we'd find out what's been going on in Texas. It doesn't seem like very much is going on in Texas. Rick Perry said no to federal funds for Medicaid expansion there, which affects about a million people, a million poor adults of working age who are not being added to the rolls down in Texas. Robert Garrett, thank you very much for joining us here on the Midday Show in Baltimore.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, am I right about that? Is that $1 million is the a million people is the estimate of who would be coverage had the governor accepted this money?
Well, it's at least a million adults that are, U.S. citizens and uninsured and under poverty. It's actually, as you know, the Medicaid expansion goes a little bit above poverty. So there's various estimates that could take the number of people closer to 2 million or 1.5 million. But the ones that are in that coverage gap we talk about that can't get they can't get the subsidies to go by in the Obamacare marketplaces or exchanges. They're just, flat out of luck, is at least a million adults in Texas.
And is there any movement on this at all? I mean, is anyone in the legislature arguing for expansion, or is this a dead issue in Texas?
Well, I think it's dead for the foreseeable future. We're, watching national midterm elections. We have our own statewide elections. The Democrats are trying to run the legitimate candidates for governor and lieutenant governor and other statewide offices. But they'd rather, I think, talk about public schools and crowded freeways than talk about Medicaid expansion. They will talk about it some. All indications are that the demographic change that's coming in Texas won't happen in time for the November 2014 election for Democrats. But Republicans who are sort of serious about taking care of hospitals and looking at that federal money you guys have been talking about, a number of them tell me they think it's going to be several years, and maybe some of them think it's going to have to be when Obama is out of the White House before Texas can swallow hard and take this money.
Hmm. Rick Perry is not running for a fourth term, but this is what he had to say about Medicaid expansion in Texas and Obamacare.
We have turned the Constitution on its head, and the federal government has inserted itself into every aspect of American society. And instead of allowing states to become laboratories of reform, Washington's central planners are co-opting the responsibilities reserved to the states and individuals under the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution. See, a federal policy of fiscal coercion is now at the heart of the debates of Medicaid expansion proposed under Obamacare. And unfortunately, some of our friends and allies in the conservative movement have folded in the face of federal bribery and mounting pressure from special interest groups.
Hmm. Interesting phrases there, fiscal coercion. And the other one, let the states become laboratories of reforms. Nothing would happen here if the federal government hadn't taken the lead here. Was there any movement in Robert Garrett, any movement in Texas during Rick Perry's term of office to address uninsured Texans?
Well, he would say yes, in that they applied under George W. Bush's administration for a waiver to take some money and do a subsidies of private insurance for the working poor. But historically, I think you'd be hard-pressed to make an argument that Texas in recent decades was a laboratory just trying to work out new ways to cover the poor. I mean, that's clearly not our political history. Our political history is to sort of treat poverty as a moral defect and hope that by having a very lean social safety net, people will have all of the sticks forcing them to work. And take care of themselves and extended families and that sort of thing. And that's why, I mean, the Texas Medicaid program has, you know, been 48th and how much they'll allow a poor family of parents to either earn or if they're working or have. I mean, you basically can't get on Medicaid in Texas if you are an adult who doesn't have a lot of children. So I think that is clearly all those words you just heard Governor Perry say are could easily be translated as I'm not the governor of New Jersey who's expanded Medicaid. I'm not any of those guys that were tempted by that money. I'm a pure, you know, constitutional conservative.
Hey, just let me throw these numbers to you about eligibility for Medicaid. Alabama is the stingiest state, according to the LA Times analysis here. Parents of dependent children aren't eligible for Medicaid if they earn more than $3,221 a year. And Texas isn't far behind. Its ceiling is $3,737.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
It's tough,
yeah,
to get it anyway, and that's not even with the I'm not talking about the expansion.
Oh yeah,
this is just the program that's in place now.
Yeah, yeah, right? and actually that's all kind of an artifact of when Medicaid was initially established in 1965. It was keyed off of AFDC, Aid for Family of Dependent Children, welfare eligibility rules, which were kind of in that, like, you know, 30% to 40% of the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the Medicaid success stories over the past decades have been covering pregnant women, covering more children, but parents and particularly childless adults, like just
that,
languishing.
And that was the idea.
And that was
with
the idea
ACA,
behind the ACA. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Robert Garrett, before I let you go, I just need to ask you about the governor's race. Then Wendy Davis, the Democratic state senator, she's one candidate, and then your attorney general, Greg Abbott, is the Republican, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and has this issue come up at all in any of the in the campaigns? Is Wendy Davis talking about it?
Well, Wendy Davis is talking about it some. Greg Abbott, the Republican, is not talking about this. I don't think he wants to talk about health care. And she is going to point out that I think your earlier discussion of in Virginia, Terry McAuliffe is saying, Virginia is losing $5 million a day. I think in Texas it's more like $19 million a day, but we're not hearing Greg Abbott or Rick Perry talk about that.
Well, Robert Garrett, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Dan.
Yep, nice to talk to you. Robert Garrett's a reporter for the Dallas Morning News based in Austin, covers the legislature there and Texas politics. Thank you very much. So, Brad, where do we go from here? I don't. I think it was interesting to talk about because Maryland, we have Medicaid expansion.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just wonder how this plays out for how long. You need to have, as Bob was saying, a change in the White House, a change in the State House, in order for this this aid to get to people in these states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean that if maybe there's a sliver of optimism, right? So maybe it could be that once a new president comes in, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, that'll just kind of ease the tension a little bit in the state.
Because the name
it's no longer
because
Obama.
Obama.
Yeah. You know, so maybe some of that, maybe that'll be it. And maybe there's turnover, like even in Texas, right? Even if they move from Rick Perry to a new Republican governor, maybe it'll be easier for that Republican governor to come along and do it because he's not been on record with so many, you know, partisan things to say in the past, right? So if that's kind of me thinking optimistically about how things might change, pessimistically, I don't know. Like, I mean, if you look at Nate Silver and his projections for the Senate
midterm
race,
yeah.
I mean, he's kind of predicting that the Senate turning Republican is possible with the House staying Republican. I mean, imagine what the politics are going to look like over the next 2 years if they're passing bills that now Obama has to veto and all that's leading up to the presidential election and
Give us a lot to talk about here on the show, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Hey, Brad, thanks for being with us again.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Brad Herring from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health helps us up here all the time whenever we call on him to help with issues Obamacare. So thank you again.
You're welcome.
And we're going to take a break here for a lunch brought to us today by Breathe Bookstore Cafe, serving inspired vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free savories and sweets. Open 7 days a week at 810 West 36th Street in good old Hamden. Breathebooks.com for more information. Please enjoy your lunch, Brad. Folks, we'll see you for the second hour of the show.